Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. As I mentioned the previous two episodes, since I started this podcast, I've received hundreds of emails asking about the events on the day of the assassination and afterwards that lead me to believe that there was a conspiracy to kill President John F. Kennedy. People want to know the absolutes I stand by regarding the Kennedy assassination, those key points that, in my view, prove a conspiracy, or at least suggest that things were not as they seemed or as we were told they were. Today, we continue our miniseries that we're calling The JFK Assassination: Hills to Die On. A hill to die on refers to a cause, belief, or position someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. Over the next several episodes, I'll be covering what I consider the crucial points, the hills to die on when it comes to the JFK assassination. The last couple of episodes, we have been looking at impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks and months before the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Last week, we heard about sightings of two Oswalds in Dallas just a couple of days before the assassination, one on a city bus, the other at the Dobbs House restaurant in Dallas, and then we heard the incredible and sad story of Ralph Leon Yates, as he picked up the Oswald double on Wednesday, November 20th, and gave him a ride to the corner of Elm and Houston, which happens to be the location of the Texas School Book Depository building. If you missed that episode last week, you must go back and listen. But this week, we look at sightings of the Oswald double on the day of the assassination. You're not going to believe some of this.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The time is 12:32 p.m. on November 22, 1963. President John F. Kennedy was just shot in Dealey Plaza about 90 seconds earlier. Lee Harvey Oswald is spotted by Dallas police officer Marion Baker in the second floor lunchroom of the Texas School Book Depository, calmly standing drinking a soda. Oswald then casually walks out the front door of the depository where all the Dallas cops have gathered. He is seen there by co-worker Buell Wesley Frazier. Oswald then walks a few blocks and boards a city bus. At this exact same time, Marvin Robinson was driving through Dealey Plaza and had to slam on the brakes in his Cadillac to avoid hitting a light-colored Nash Rambler station wagon just ahead of him that had suddenly pulled over beside the curb. Robinson says the Rambler picked up a man running down the grass from the depository. Robinson's story is supported by Roy Cooper, Robinson's employee who was in the car behind Robinson. Cooper says he saw the man coming down the incline, wave at the Rambler, and then jump in. Neither Robinson nor Cooper were able to identify the person they saw running to the Rambler. Helen Forrest and James Pennington, however, did get a good look at the man. Both Forrest and Pennington also say they saw a man running down the incline in Dealey Plaza and then got into the Rambler station wagon. They both said that the man they saw looked exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald. Sheriff Roger Craig is another witness to corroborate this story. Sheriff Craig was standing in front of the courthouse when the motorcade passed by. He heard gunshots and started running into Dealey Plaza, where he began looking for bullet marks. Here's Roger Craig talking about what he saw.
As I was searching the south curb of Elm Street, I heard a shrill whistle, and I looked up. It just drew my attention. It was coming from across the street, and there was a light green Rambler station wagon driving real slow west on Elm Street, and the driver was leaning over to his right, looking up at a man running down the grass. So I immediately tried to cross the street to take these two people into custody for questioning. You know, everybody else was coming to the scene. These were the only two people leaving. And this was suspicious in my mind, you know, at the time. So I wanted to talk to them. but I couldn't get across the street because the city officer who was stationed at Houston and Elm had left his post, and the traffic, you know, was so heavy I just couldn't get across the street to him. But I did get a good look at the man coming down the grassy knoll, and he got in the station wagon, and they drove west on Elm Street. I called Captain Fritz at his office and gave him a description of the man I saw get into the Rambler. And he told me, and I quote him, "It sounds like the suspect we have in custody. Come on up and take a look at him." So I went out and got in my unmarked car and drove to the city hall, went directly to Captain Fritz's office. And we went into Captain Fritz's inner office. The man was sitting in a chair behind a desk. And there was another gentleman. I assumed he was one of Fritz's people because he had the white cowboy hat on, which was the trademark at that time of the Dallas Homicide Bureau. And Fritz turned to me and said, "Is this the man you saw?" And I said, "Yes." And it was. So he turned to the suspect and he said, "This man saw you leave." At which time the suspect became a little excited. And he said, "I told you people I did." And Fritz said, "Now take it easy, son," talking to the suspect. He said, "We're just trying to find out what happened here." He said, "What about the car?" I didn't say station wagon. He said, "What about the car?" At which time the suspect leaned forward and put both hands up on the desk and said, "That station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne. Don't try to drag her into this." Then he leaned back and very disgustedly said, "Everybody will know who I am now." Now, this was not a brag. I know it's been blown up to be a brag in the Warren Commission. But this was not a brag. This was a man
he was embarrassed about it.
Or disgusted that he had blown his cover or been caught or something. You know, it wasn't a brag.
We know the real Lee Harvey Oswald left the Texas School Book Depository and hopped on a city bus. He was seen and recognized by Mary Bledsoe, plus he had the bus transfer in his pocket after his arrest. He then got off the bus and took a cab to his rooming house in Oak Cliff. So who was this mysterious figure that numerous witnesses say they saw run out of the depository, run down the grassy incline, and hop into a Nash Rambler station wagon? And supposedly this man looked identical to Lee Harvey Oswald. Some people want to believe that Payne's station wagon was used to pick up the Oswald lookalike, based on what Oswald told Sheriff Roger Craig and Captain Will Fritz. Besides the mysterious Nash Rambler station wagon that was in the end spotted by mutually supportive witnesses, Craig, Forrest, Pennington, Robertson, and Cooper, there may have been other cars even more deeply in the shadows that helped Lee Harvey Oswald make his otherwise unlikely transition that climactic afternoon in the assassination plot. Another car appeared out of nowhere when he arrived at his rooming house. After Oswald went to his house at 1 p.m., the housekeeper, Earlene Roberts, saw a police car stop directly in front of the house. She told the Warren Commission that two uniformed policemen were in the car. The driver sounded the horn, just kind of tit-tit, twice, an unmistakable signal, then eased the car forward and went around the corner. After about 3 or 4 minutes, Oswald returned from his room and went outside. Before Mrs. Roberts turned her attention elsewhere, she saw Oswald standing in front of the house by a northbound bus stop, to be heard from next in the Warren report 12 minutes later as the apparent killer of Officer J.D. Tippett near the corner of 10th and Patton, almost 1 mile away in the opposite direction. How he got there in time to kill Tippett, or even if he did, has never been clearly established. He may have been picked up by the Dallas police car that parked briefly in front of the house, beeped its horn twice lightly, and drove around the corner, perhaps to circle around the block and return for him. Earlene Roberts told the Warren Commission that the number on the police car was 107. As the commission staff would discover, the Dallas Police Department no longer had a Car 107. It had sold Car 107 on April 17, 1963 to a used car dealer. The Dallas Police would not resume using the number 107 until February 1964, 3 months after the assassination. If Mrs. Roberts had the car number right, then the horn signal to Oswald came from two uniformed men in a counterfeit police car. Their likely destination, with Oswald as their passenger, was the Texas Theater, where they would drop off Oswald for a setup for his arrest and murder, while the Oswald imposter in the Nash Rambler was being led off for a short walk to meet Officer J.D. Tippett in a fatal encounter at 10th and Patton. The Warren report describes the murder of Officer Tippett, quote, at approximately 1:15 p.m., after he confronted a man walking east along the south side of Patton. The man's general description was similar to the one broadcast over the police radio.
Attention all squad. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
Tippett stopped the man and called him to his car. He approached the car and apparently exchanged words with Tippett through the right front or vent window. Tippett got out and started to walk around the front of the car. As Tippett reached the left front wheel, the man pulled out a revolver and fired several shots. Four bullets hit Tippett and killed him instantly. The gunman started back toward Patton Avenue, ejecting the empty cartridge cases before reloading with fresh bullets, end quote. As the gunman walked and trotted away from the murder scene while still holding the revolver, the Warren report says he was seen by at least 12 persons. Quote, by the evening of November 22nd, five of them had identified Lee Harvey Oswald in police lineups as the man they saw. A sixth did so the next day. Three others subsequently identified Oswald from a photograph. Two witnesses testified that Oswald resembled the man they had seen. One witness felt he was too distant from the gunman to make a positive identification, end quote. The fleeing man, identified later as Lee Harvey Oswald, was seen finally by Johnny Calvin Brewer, manager of Hardy's Shoe Store, located a few doors east of the Texas Theater. After spotting the man acting suspiciously in the recess area in front of his store, Brewer went outside. He saw the man ducking into the theater up the block. The ticket seller, Julia Postal, confirmed to Brewer that the man had not bought a ticket. She then called the police.
Johnny, when was the first time you saw Lee Harvey Oswald?
Saw him that Friday afternoon, November 22nd. He walked into the lobby of my store.
How far in did he walk out there, John?
A few feet. He was standing right where those tennis shoes are right there, just about 5 feet from the door there.
What made you suspicious of this man who walked into the lobby?
Well, right after the president had been shot, they broadcast a description on the radio of this man. It was 5'8", 5'9", 150 pounds. And this Oswald matched the description. And just a few minutes before he walked into the lobby, on the radio they had a bulletin that an officer had been shot here in Oak Cliff. And he walked in, he matched the description. Looked scared, just the way he stood there.
You were standing right here behind the counter?
Standing right here behind the counter, listening to the radio.
And where did he walk to? How far into the lobby did he come?
He walked right into the right-hand side of the lobby there, just a few feet from the door, and stood there looking in at the shoes there.
Were there a lot of police cars in the area?
Yeah, there was a lot of police cars. There were some cars coming up Jefferson Street. They made that U-turn there and went back down Jefferson, and when they did, Oswald turned and walked up to the theater. When he went out the lobby and toward the theater, I walked out to the sidewalk and watched him go in. Then I walked up to the theater and asked Miss Postal there, the cashier, if she had sold a ticket to this man wearing the brown sports shirt, you know, his description. She called the police.
However, the man who shot Tippett, fled the murder scene, sneaked into the Texas Theater just before 1:45 p.m., and was identified as Lee Harvey Oswald, posed another bi-location problem. Once again, Oswald seemed to be in two places at the same time. According to Warren Butch Burroughs, the concession stand operator at the Texas Theater, Lee Harvey Oswald entered the theater sometime between 1 and 1:07 p.m., several minutes before Officer Tippett was slain 7 blocks away. If true, Butch Burroughs' observation would eliminate Oswald as a candidate for Tippett's murder. Perhaps for that reason, Burroughs was asked by a Warren Commission attorney the apparent straightforward question, quote, did you see Oswald come in the theater, end quote. Burroughs would answer honestly, quote, no sir, I didn't, end quote. What something reading this testimony would not know is that Butch Burrows was unable to see anyone enter the theater from where he was standing at his concession stand, unless that person came into the area where he was working. As he explained to me in an interview, there was a partition between his concession stand and the front door. Someone could enter the theater, go directly up a flight of stairs to the balcony, and not be seen from the concession stand. That, Burrows said, is what Oswald apparently did. However, Burrows still knew Oswald come into the theater between 1 and 1:07 p.m. because he saw him inside the theater soon after that. As he told me, he sold popcorn to Oswald 1:15 p.m., information that the Warren Commission did not solicit from him in his testimony. When Oswald bought his popcorn at 1:15 p.m., this was exactly the same time the Warren report said Officer J.D. Tippett was being shot to death, evidently by someone else. Burrows would have this to say about the time Oswald entered the theater on the Men Who Killed Kennedy series.
We were playing two movies called War is Hell with Audie Murphy and Cry Battle with Van Heflin. And we started the movie at 1 o'clock, and I was carrying candy behind the candy case. And he also slipped in around between 1 and 1:07.
Burrows also told author James Douglas the jaw-dropping information that he sold Oswald popcorn at 1:15 p.m. If Oswald arrived at the theater between 1 and 1:07 and he bought popcorn from Burrows at 1:15, it would be impossible for Oswald to have killed Dallas officer J.D. Tippett, since the murder happened around 1:15 according to the Warren report. But then again, that would also mean that if Burrows is right about the time, that Oswald must have gotten a ride to the Texas Theater to be there by 1:07. We know that he could not have walked there that fast. But we already know from Brewer and Postal that there was a person who was wearing a brown shirt who came in off Jefferson Boulevard much later after the radio had already broadcast Tippett's shooting. But wouldn't Burrows know if he had sold popcorn to someone? How could he have sold popcorn to Oswald 1:15 if Oswald didn't enter the building till at least 25 minutes later around 1:40 p.m.? There were about 15 to 20 people in the theater at that time. Before Oswald bought his popcorn, he sat down in the seat right next to Jack Davis, who was 18 years old at the time and was never interviewed by the Warren Commission. Davis wondered why this man was sitting next to him in a theater with hundreds of open seats. Davis then saw Oswald get up and move to another seat, which was also next to one of the few people in the theater. Davis said it looked like Oswald was looking for someone he didn't know personally. Davis said Oswald sat next to a few other people for a very short time and then got up and walked to the lobby. It was at this time that Oswald bought popcorn from Burrows, who said it was at 1:15 p.m. After Burrows sold him popcorn, he saw Oswald walk back in the lower section of the theater and sat next to a pregnant woman. Burrows recalls that after some time, the pregnant woman got up and went to the ladies' restroom, and he recalls hearing the restroom door close shortly before the Dallas police came rushing into the theater. Here's fellow researchers Vince Palmero and the late Jim Mars talking about Oswald's movements in the theater that day.
When Oswald's in the theater, and according to witnesses, he's like going from person to person to person in the theater. He's like getting up and he moves like four or five times going next to the people in the theater. It's like he's like waiting for orders or waiting for a handler or something.
In fact, Jack Davis that I interviewed was an 18-year-old kid. Now picture this, you're an 18-year-old kid and you're off work and so you're in out of school and you're going to go see this war movie. So you go to this theater and it's got 900 seats in it. And there's only about 20 people in there and they're scattered just all around the theater. So you go and sit near the back over in the right section by yourself. And the next thing you know, this young fella comes in, squeezes past you and sits in the seat next to you. He's going like, you know, what's this? What does this guy want? But the guy doesn't say anything. And pretty soon, just within moments, nobody says anything. So he stands up and then scoots past the guy, goes out and goes across the aisle, sits in the middle section over there, third row, third seat. You know, and so this guy kept his eye on him because it's like, I wonder what he wanted. And then pretty soon he saw the police come in, saw the house lights come up, and they all came up and grabbed him. It was Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay? So not only was Oswald in there apparently trying to make some kind of contact, but he also, Jack Davis said that he'd just gotten in the show and settled down, and the feature had started, and it started at 10 after 1, which means that he saw and encountered Oswald in the theater minutes before Officer Tippett was shot. Oswald didn't do it. He was in the theater. Right. And the Butch Burroughs, the assistant manager of the Texas Theater, has confirmed that to me, too. If you go check his Warren Commission testimony, he talks about how somebody sneaked into the theater about 1:30, and he heard the doors open, and he went around to collect a ticket, but there was nobody there. And he thought that whoever had slipped in might have gone up to the balcony. And that's what he's quoted telling this story in the Warren Commission. That's why everybody thinks that this is how they got on to Oswald, because they figured somebody slipped in the theater without paying for his ticket. But when I went and sat down and carefully interviewed Butch Burroughs, he said, yes, all that happened, but that was not Oswald. He said Oswald came to the theater shortly after the show opened at 1 o'clock, and that, in fact, he came out and saw him moving around, which corroborates Jack Davis's story, and then he said he came out and bought popcorn from him. So here's another witness, alibi witness, can place Oswald in the theater when Officer Tippit was shot. So see, this throws the whole Officer Tippit shooting just up in the air, because all these years they've argued, and I've heard people say over and over, well, you know, if he wasn't guilty of shooting the president, then why did he shoot the cop? Okay, right. Well, now we can just turn that around and say, well, since we can prove he didn't shoot the cop, maybe he didn't shoot the president, like he said.
Oh, man. So let me get this right. So Oswald's in the theater buying popcorn. I mean, and he's going from person to person, like waiting for a handler. Obviously, yep. He's a patsy. Obviously, he's been set up. Now, were any of these people interviewed by the Warren Commission who saw Oswald? There you go again.
No. Jack Davis wasn't interviewed, and Butch Burroughs, like I said, had told of two entries, and they only reported his account of one. You know, the whole thing's just screwy.
It would be helpful if there was a way to know what all of the witnesses who were in the theater that day had to say, not just Jack Davis. But unfortunately, none of the witnesses gave statements to the FBI or Warren Commission about what they saw, and they've been really hard to track down. But in 1998, at of all things a school function for one of my sons, I was speaking with a man who was asking me about my research into the assassination. We knew each other and he was aware I was a researcher. He said to me, by the way, you need to speak with my uncle who lives in Dallas. He was in the theater the day that Oswald was arrested, and what's funny is his story doesn't match up with what you hear on the documentaries about what happened that day in the theater. So to make a long story short, I was able to contact his uncle and conduct an interview with him about what he saw that day in the theater. Mr. Alpike would then proceed to tell me an incredible story. He was sitting in the theater's balcony, and a young man who he always thought was Lee Harvey Oswald came and sat next to him in the balcony of the theater. He thought it was strange that the man sat next to him, because the balcony only had like 3 to 4 people up there, and there was a ton of empty seats, and the man sat right next to him. He said it actually made him feel uncomfortable. After a few minutes, he said the man asked him if he had some bazooka bubble gum, and he said, excuse me? So the man asked him again, and he said, I said, no, I do not have any bazooka bubble gum. As soon as I said that, the man got up and went and sat next to another person that was several seats down. He hears the man say something to that person he sat next to, but could not make out what he said. He estimates that about 15 or 20 minutes go by, and he hears some commotion from the lower section of the theater. He hears people shouting and a man yelling, I'm not resisting arrest. He then says two police officers then come up to the balcony and go to the young man that was just a few minutes ago sitting next to him. And the man calmly gets up and leaves the balcony with the police officers. He stands up to see what's going on, and he sees the police officers take the young man at the rear exit of the theater. He would see Lee Harvey Oswald later on the news, and he told his wife that he witnessed the arrest of Oswald. He said that the man was sitting next to him was Lee Harvey Oswald, or an exact double. I told him, and by now he knew the official story, but he tells me the official story is a lie. He said, I was in the balcony with Oswald, and he was taken from the balcony by two Dallas police officers, and there was no struggle like they said it was. He said, I will go to my grave knowing that it was Lee Harvey Oswald that was in the balcony that day, and he was let out of there by two police officers. So what is the truth here? We've talked about the idea of two Oswalds already on several episodes of this podcast. As you study and research this case, there are instances in the record of people saying that they saw Oswald who seemed convinced of it, but their sightings are at times when Oswald's presence is already indisputably accounted for in the record. For example, Ralph Yates, the guy who was sent to the asylum, said he picked up a hitchhiker who looked just like Oswald and was saying things that would be incriminating for Oswald. Go back and listen to episode 10 to hear Mr. Yates' incredible story. Another example is Sterling Wood and his father seeing the man who looked just like Oswald at the gun range on a day that Oswald was with his family and Ruth Payne at the Payne house. The other big example that we've looked at in detail is when multiple witnesses saw a man who looked like Oswald running down the hill in Dealey Plaza to get into a Nash Rambler station wagon after the assassination. Go back and listen to episode 9 to hear the complete account. Also, we have the account from Mr. John Thomas, who I interviewed years ago. He said that he saw both Oswalds on a city bus, almost at the same time, just a couple of weeks before the assassination. He spoke with both men on the bus that day. So now we have another one of those potential double Oswald sightings at the Texas Theater. The mystery has to do with which exit Oswald was taking out of the theater by police after his arrest. There is also some confusion as to why some parts of the official record state that Oswald was discovered in the balcony and not the main floor of the theater. So as we continue to answer Jill's questions about the activity in the Texas Theater that day, let's look at the exit scenarios. The official story, which I believe is correct, is that Oswald was taking out the front door. There is a famous photo of Oswald struggling with police as he is taken out the front door, which resolves the issue alone. Numerous statements from officers that day, including Sergeant Hill, also support the idea that Oswald exited the Texas Theater through the lobby and then the front door. But if it really isn't disputed that Oswald went out the front door, then why are there three witnesses who say they saw Oswald taken out the back door of the theater? According to Butch Burroughs, who sold Oswald popcorn at 1:15, he saw a second arrest with the suspect taken out the back of the theater. In an interview with Jim Douglas, Burroughs said that the Dallas police arrested, quote, an Oswald lookalike, end quote, 3 or 4 minutes after they arrested Oswald and took him out the front. Burroughs said he could see the second man just as well as he could see Oswald, and that the man, quote, looked identical to Oswald, end quote. Bernard Hare, who owned Bernie's Hobby Shop, which was 2 doors down from the Texas Theater, also saw an arrest happen in the back of the theater. Hare was in the front of the theater at first, but he couldn't see what was going on because of the crowd. So he went back through his store into the alley out back. The alley was full of police cars, but there were fewer spectators. There in the back alley, Hare witnessed what he thought for years was the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. He said he saw 2 police officers bring out a young man who was a spitting image of Lee Harvey Oswald. It wasn't until 1987 that Hare found out that Oswald had been taken out the front of the theater. Al Pike told me in an interview in December 1998 that he sat next to Lee Harvey Oswald in the balcony and saw him led out of the balcony by 2 Dallas police officers a few minutes after hearing some commotion from the lower level, which apparently was the arrest of the real Lee Harvey Oswald. So from the stories of Bernard Hare, Butch Burroughs, and Al Pike, there is some evidence for the idea that another person who resembled Oswald was taken out the back door after being arrested. But is there any documentation to support the idea of an Oswald lookalike being arrested and taken out the back of the theater? Well, yes, there is. In the official homicide report for J.D. Tippett, it says, quote, suspect was later arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater, end quote. Dallas Police Detective L.D. Strangfellow said in a letter to Captain Canaway that is now in the Dallas City Archives that, quote, Oswald was arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater, end quote. You can now easily find this report online. Assassination researchers for years believed that the Oswald lookalike is the one who was arrested in the balcony and taken out the back of the theater. You may think that this is a big claim that requires a large leap. But you have to admit that something else other than what we were told by the official record was going on in the theater that day. The Oswald double, after having been put in the police car in the alley, must have been driven a short distance and released on higher intelligence orders. Unfortunately for the plotters, he was seen again soon. With the scapegoat Lee Harvey Oswald now safely in custody, we can presume that the double was not supposed to be seen again in Dallas or anywhere else. Had he not been seen, this CIA's double Oswald strategy in Oak Cliff might have eluded independent investigators forever. But thanks to other key witnesses who have emerged, we now have detailed evidence that the double was seen again, not just once, but twice. At 2 p.m., as Lee Harvey Oswald sat handcuffed in the back seat of a patrol car boxed in by police officers on his way to jail, Oswald knew the final role had been chosen for him in the assassination scenario. Also, at about 2 p.m., a man identified as looking exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald was seen in a car 8 blocks away from the Texas Theater, still very much at large and keeping a low profile. A sharp-eyed auto mechanic spotted him. T.F. White was a 60-year-old longtime employee of Mac Pate's Garage in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. While Watt worked on an automobile the afternoon of the assassination, he could hear police sirens screaming up and down Davis Street, only a block away. He also heard radio reports describing a suspect then thought to be in Oak Cliff.
The entire area has been blocked off. No one allowed in or out as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas.
The mechanic looked out to the open doors of the garage. He watched as a red 1961 Falcon drove into the parking lot of the El Chico restaurant across the street. The Falcon parked in an odd position after going a few feet into the lot. The driver remained seated in the car. Watt later said, quote, "The man in the car appeared to be hiding," end quote. Watt kept his eye on the man in the Falcon. When Mac Pate returned from his lunch break a few minutes later, T.F. Watt pointed out to his boss the oddly parked Falcon with its waiting driver who seemed to be hiding. Pate told Watt to watch the car carefully, reminding him of earlier news reports that they had heard about a possible assassination attempt against President Kennedy in Houston the day before involving a red Ford Falcon. T.F. Watt then walked across the street to investigate. He halted about 10 to 15 yards from the car. He could see the driver was wearing a white t-shirt. The man turned towards Watt and looked at him full face. Watt stared back at him. Not wanting to provoke the possible assassin, Watt began to retreat to the garage. However, he paused, took a scrap of paper from his coveralls pocket, and wrote down the Texas license plate of the car, PP4537. That night, while T.F. Watt was watching television with his wife, he recognized the Dallas Police Department's prisoner, Lee Harvey Oswald, as the man he had seen in the Red Falcon in the El Chico's parking lot. Watt was unfazed by what he did not know, that at the same time he had seen the once Oswald sitting freely in the Falcon, the other Oswald was sitting handcuffed in a Dallas police car on his way to jail. Mrs. Watt, fearing for encompassing arms of a conspiracy, talked her husband out of reporting this information to the authorities. On Wednesday, December 4, 1963, Wes Wise, a future mayor of Dallas, Texas, was speaking in front of a crowd at the Elks Exchange Club. The subject matter soon turned to the assassination of President Kennedy and the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. After the discussion ended, Mr. Wise was approached by Mac Pate. Mac Pate told Wise that one of his employees saw Lee Harvey Oswald sitting in a car with the engine running across the street from his repair shop about 2 p.m. on November 22, 1963, the day President Kennedy was assassinated. Pate then took Mr. Wise to meet his employee, Mr. T.F. Watt. Watt described the man he had seen in the red Ford car across the street in the El Chico parking lot. Mr. Watt told Wes Wise the man was Lee Harvey Oswald, but at 2 p.m. on the afternoon of November 22, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was in custody at police headquarters. Wes Wise wrote a few brief notes of his conversation with Pate and Mr. Watt on the left side of the invitation he had received to speak at the Elks Exchange Club. He wrote the license plate number PP4537 down. Wise would then check out some details about this car with the FBI and discovered a number of curious facts. License plate PP4537 was the number of a 1957 Plymouth, not a 1961 Falcon. The 1957 Plymouth was registered to one Carl Amos Mather. Carl Mather and his wife were good friends of Officer Tippett's widow, and indeed had visited Marie Tippit a few hours after the policeman's murder. Carl Mather worked for Collins Radio, which was a subsidized profit corporation contracted to the CIA. One remaining question is why, who, and when were one or more license plates from Carl Mather's 1957 four-door blue Plymouth put on a red 1961 Ford Falcon, driven and possibly owned by someone who looked identical to Lee Harvey Oswald, at 2 p.m. on November 22, 1963? Another remaining question is the extent of Carl Mather's involvement in the events of November 22, 1963. Mather worked for Collins Radio, who worked hand-in-hand with the CIA in numerous projects involving Cuba, Vietnam, and Southeast Asia in the early 1960s. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. I wanted to let you all know that we will not have an episode for the next 2 weeks, as I will be traveling to visit family and friends during the holidays. Our next episode will be released on Wednesday, January 8th, and boy, you don't want to miss it. As we've been talking about possible Oswald impersonations in and around Dallas, leading up to and the day of the assassination, we have saved the best for last. The story of a man who claims he was in a getaway plane that left Dallas on November 22, 1963, with the Oswald imposter on board. I hope each and every one of you have a blessed Christmas and a happy new year. Thank you for your support of this podcast and my book over this past year. We'll see you in 2025.